Sometimes I think I'm crazy. Please don't weigh in on that. I already know the verdict isn't out just yet, but I have a feeling I am. But I've noticed more and more people over the last few years really have gotten into the keto diet. But going off a hunch is just not enough. So I wanted to look up some statistics. As of February of 2023, so literally just this last month, the percentage of people in the United States who do the keto diet is about 5%. And you're thinking to yourself, okay, Melissa, that definitely doesn't support what you're saying. Actually, when you equate that, that is close to 13 million Americans in 2023 who are currently or are trying right now the keto diet. It's very popular. I knew I was right. All right, we're going to turn now to Dr. Wong, who is with Hartford Healthcare this morning. And we're going to talk about the keto diet, but specifically also touching on sugar substitutes. So Dr. Andrew Wong, again, primary care physician with Hartford Healthcare's medical group in Westport. Thanks for being back on the show. How are you?
Hi, Melissa. Good morning. Great to be talking with you again.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here. So, Dr. Wong, before we dive into sugars, let's just really quickly recap. For people who are not familiar with the keto diet, what is it?
Yes. So the keto diet originated from kind of like a high-protein, low-carb diet. The Atkins diet that was very popular in the 1990s. And Dr. Atkins was a nephrologist who realized that, hey, if we don't eat carbs, that shuts off a calorie storage mechanism in the liver that causes us to gain weight. And many people kind of went on to this high protein, even high fat diet. So, hey, I get to eat bacon, I get to eat meat, some vegetables, but you cannot eat any sugar, you cannot eat any carbs, which at the time was kind of a revolutionary idea, because prior to that we had the no-fat, high-carb diet, and a lot of desserts came out that kind of touted as such. So this was kind of like a 180, and people really liked it. A lot of people lost weight. Now, the problem was Dr. Atkins passed away from a heart attack, so they quickly changed the name from a Atkins diet to ketogenic diet to make it sound more scientific. A ketogenic diet, again, high fat, high protein, there's different variations too. So there's a diet called the paleo diet, which I'm personally a fan of because the paleo diet is a little bit less restrictive. Whereas the ketogenic diet really focuses on saturated fats. In fact, not just having more meat, but adding saturated oils to your meat, like coconut oil. some people do lose weight with it. It's not a sustainable diet. People cannot live permanently on a ketogenic diet. If you're looking to lose weight quickly, there is proof that it helps, but people will rubber band back to their original weights when they stop. I don't consider it a healthy diet. I think it's more of a diet where you lose weight quickly for superficial reasons, not health reasons.
I agree. So, and Dr. Wong, I know this personally because I tried the keto diet. I don't even remember when. I think it was during the pandemic, somewhere in there. It all kind of blends together. But I had tried it. So my mother-in-law, I should say it's complicated, but my in-laws had tried it, and she lost weight very quickly, and I thought, wow, this is the best you've looked in a really long time. You know, maybe I should try it. And I'm in no way, I think what a doctor would say is overweight, but I always am like looking for ways to, a little baby fat here, whatever. So I try it. Holy moly. I mean, I would say within a month I was down easily 10 pounds within like a month, 10 or 12 pounds.
It really worked for you.
So I'm like, all right, this is awesome. Let's stick with this. So it was amazing because my husband also did it. And he's very into nutrition and like what ingredients are in there and how is this all going to compile at the end. And he was the one who pointed out, he's like, there's just so much added. And as much as it's like, yeah, the high protein, like that's great. He said, I feel like I'm going to have a heart attack. Like, I feel like I am clogging my arteries with the keto diet. And I feel like I'm doing all this stuff to my body that even though aesthetically, like you just said, for looks, it looks like I'm doing great. But internally, he's like, I don't feel good. And so we stopped keto. Honestly, we did it maybe for a month and a half. And then we stopped immediately and went back to like the traditional workout, eat right, hydrate, yada, yada, yada. Tell me, if you don't mind, Dr. Wong, what is happening in your body internally? So you're losing the fat very quickly, but what's happening internally with the foods you're choosing to put in your mouth if you're on a keto diet?
Yeah, that's where it gets complicated, because we don't know if people are losing fat. Are they losing muscle? Is the ketogenic diet just a variation of a calorie restriction diet? And because we have such a draconian or strict diet selection, maybe we're just eating less overall. So a lot of unfortunate additives that we're putting into a ketogenic diet, and the saturated fats for one. I've seen people go on to ketogenic diets and their cholesterol and triglycerides go through the roof. So it's almost an irony that you're doing something that we think is healthier, but it's actually increasing our cardiovascular risk. And that's what we're seeing with a lot of these, what I'll say, processed chemicals or artificial chemicals that we use to enhance these diets. And score one for my mom, ever since the days when we were kids, and back in the days, the only artificial sweetener was Sweet 'n Low. I remember those pink packets would have that warning on the back, Sweet 'n Low contains saccharin, which has been proven to cause cancer.
Oh,
and ever since
right.
then,
sure.
Remember those days, yeah. And ever since then, my mom said, no artificial sweeteners, no Sweet 'n Low, and then NutraSweet came out, no NutraSweet.
I think I remember that, Dr. Wong. When did that come out that it was like, check the artificial sweeteners? Because I remember being a kid and my mom and dad, who always make their coffee from home, I will never forget when they went into their cabinets. I don't know why this stands out to me, but as you're saying that, they changed to, oh my gosh, Stevia? Is it Stevia?
That's right. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. So there was Splenda and then Stevia, which is actually natural. So it comes from a plant which tastes sweet, but it's zero calorie. Now, what happened is that they took it one step further. It's actually natural. So that's the kicker. It's called erythritol. And erythritol is, we call it a fruit alcohol. So it grows naturally in fruits like pears and grapes and mushrooms naturally, and it gives sweet flavor. It's a filler. It's a very pleasing taste to the mouth. So Stevia, as well as Splenda, started adding erythritol to their sweeteners. And that kind of goes along with a paleo diet, because in paleo, you're not supposed to have any carbs. Well, hey, here's your sugar. And it gives you zero calories. So that fits in perfectly with a ketogenic diet.
We're talking to Dr. Wong this morning, and we were just diving into the keto diet, but specifically now talking about sugar substitutes. And we had just talked, Dr. Andrew Wong, about some of the sugar substitutes just for your coffee, for example, like the artificial sweeteners. What other sugar substitutes do you see specifically with keto that could be troublesome for people?
Right. So the newer brands like Splenda, like Stevia, they've added another sweetener called erythritol, which is a naturally occurring sugar fruit alcohol, which gives a sweet taste, but it's very low calorie and it's very pleasing to our tastes. So, and it's natural. So these companies have added erythritol to a lot of their products. Now, the problem is that in nature, erythritol occurs in very low quantities in pears, grapes, mushrooms, but it's super concentrated in sugary products or processed foods. And so researchers at the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Hazen, actually, they're doing really good work there. What they do is that they evaluate blood for people who have had heart attacks and strokes, and they identify all the different substances and chemicals that are in the, those individuals' bloods that are unusual, and they try to find trends. And one very positive trend they found was that many of those patients had high levels of erythritol in their blood, which it's unfortunate because people are consuming sugar substitutes with the idea that, hey, this is going to be good for my diabetes and my obesity, and it's going to help me live a healthier life. And I guess it's almost like the margarine butter craze that we used to have, or the high carb craze that we used to have. It turned out that it looks like these chemicals that we think are making us healthier are actually doubling or tripling our risk of stroke and heart attack.
So, Dr. Wong, break this down for me a little bit more. First of all, I want to keep calling it arithmetic. What is it called?
Erythritol.
So erythritol. Got it. Yep. So if that is found like at high levels in the bloodstream, like you're saying, what does that mean? Like, what does that lead to? What are the concerns with seeing that?
Yeah, so we're talking about, it gets tricky because we know that sugar in high quantities are bad for diabetes reasons. We know that fat is bad because that leads to heart disease. And then there's kind of this new phenomenon, which in a way mankind has done to itself, manufacturing processed foods. It's an area that I think the science really needs to catch up with the everyday. Because there's things that we do every day, like carbon paper that we get as receipts, plastics that we use, cardboard that we use, and they contain chemicals like BPAs, styrenes, and those have been proven to cause cancer, early puberty, thyroid risk. So the science really needs to catch up with what we do every day. But what the erythritol does is that it inflames the blood. So in the quantities that we're consuming it, and so one serving of erythritol is about 15 grams. And there was a very sharp incidence of heart disease and stroke with 30 grams. So two servings of erythritol, which would be equivalent to like a pint of ice cream. You know, with all the best intentions, I buy a pint and I try to space it out over a few days, but I always eat it in one day, or perhaps two cookies, two muffins. So two portions in a day of erythritol will double your risk of getting a heart attack or stroke. And we think that the erythritol is actually causing the blood to get inflamed. When the blood becomes inflamed, it clots and causes a stroke or heart attack.
Wow. So I think, Dr. Wong, I want to end on a note, which is just education. What should people be looking for in those labels whenever they get, you know, maybe they don't even realize that it's artificial sugar that they're getting or a sugar substitute. What stands out on a label, even if you're getting, you know, I think of the people who go to Trader Joe's even and they get like chocolates that they feel like are going to be healthier because it's from Trader Joe's. What ingredients do you want to be a no-no? Should we avoid?
Yeah. The most common ones are erythritol. So make sure that anything you're buying does not contain erythritol in it. Some of the other chemicals that I've seen that have caused issues are magnesium stearate, SLS, which is sodium lauryl sulfate. And each one of those deserves its own, you know, conversation. But what I will say is that when you go to the supermarket, try to get foods that do not have added ingredients. But if they do, so for example, something like Dave's Killer Bread, you look at the ingredients and it gets confusing because there's probably 30 or 40 ingredients in it, but it actually is very healthy. When you look through the ingredients, if there are four or more ingredients that are not natural, that don't sound natural, don't buy it.
Right.
So that's the definition of an ultra-processed food. And the statistics are scary. Americans get about 60% of their nutrition from ultra-processed foods. We get about 90% of our sugar from ultra-processed foods.
And the definition, no wonder we have obesity problems. I'm just saying, like, that. There's the proof in the pudding right there. I mean, what you just said.
So if there's one message I want to get across, look at your labels. If there's four or more ingredients that sound like chemicals that you can't pronounce, don't buy it. And things always change. Hopefully this is the tip of the iceberg and there will be more research in a lot of these fillers, artificial substances that are put into foods to give flavor, to give longevity. It all starts with making sure that you see your doctor or your primary care provider, and they can point you in the right direction of seeing a nutritionist, seeing a metabolic expert, seeing a men's or women's health specialist. In Hartford Healthcare, we have all those specialties and more. We're in Fairfield County. We're beyond. So if you're looking for a provider, give Hartford Healthcare a try. We have all the specialists that you would need to live not just a long life, but a strong life as well.
Which is very important in today's world, especially. Dr. Andrew Wong, primary care physician with Hartford Healthcare's Medical Group in Westport, I thank you so much for sharing all these details this morning, and I know we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Melissa. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. We are welcoming back to the show this morning Elizabeth Menigan, and we introduced you to Elizabeth earlier this year. She is the creator of a new app that I told you all about, Hands to Paws, and it's the number 2, Hands to Paws. And the real reason that Elizabeth came up with this, which, by the way, it's not her full-time job. This is something she decided to do because she's so passionate about dogs, and as am I. And one of the biggest issues we see here in America are dogs being sold and going through breeding in really bad standards, illegal standards. And puppy mills are on the rise. They have been for a very long time. And unfortunately, a lot of times people are desiring certain dogs, designer dogs, and they're willing to go to any length, pay any dollar amount for that type of dog. And a lot of times they don't even realize that they are supporting not great places, including puppy mills. So Elizabeth is here this morning, and we're specifically going to dive into deceptive advertising when it comes to your next dog that you find online. So good morning, Elizabeth. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good morning. I am very well, thank you.
I'm glad to have you here this morning. First of all, what are the most common things you will find in deceptive advertising when it comes to buying a dog online?
Sure. I think the first thing to remember is ethical breeders never post on social media. So an ethical breeder, you will never find a Facebook ad or an Instagram ad. So that's the first thing going into it you have to be aware of. There's an alarming trend in fraud, bait and switch, and no puppy. So consumers are answering an ad, a pop-up ad or an Instagram ad that looks like a legitimate kennel with a very cute picture of a puppy. You may not get that puppy. You may give a deposit and never even get a puppy, or you'll send money, they'll send you a dog, and it's not the dog that's in the photo. Mm-hmm. And it's happening, it's an epidemic, and it's happening all the time.
So
and there
are
loopholes.
Yeah, and I want to get into the loopholes. I think the thing that is really concerning here, and it's like anything, right, Elizabeth? I mean, when you want to get designer shoes, you want to get certain clothing, anything. I think there is a very thin, you know, there's a very weird line there where social media can sometimes, or even just going online, you can totally miss the mark. So what I mean by this is, you know, things like Facebook Marketplace, for example, people have had great success with Facebook Marketplace. I myself have used it, and it's great. But there will be like pop-up ads like you were mentioning, or there will be advertisements or things that are even on your, maybe like on your Facebook feed, for example, that look legitimate. And what do you suggest? I mean, we've talked a little bit about this with the Better Business Bureau. What do you suggest if people first see, you know, oh, my gosh, look at these beautiful corgis, for example. Oh, my gosh, these beautiful corgis, they are available. This is amazing. Instead of just clicking on it, what would be your better suggestion? Obviously, Hands to Paws, which we'll tell people about in a minute. But, like, what would be your suggestion?
Download the app. Right. The corgi may not even be right for you.
Right. But besides the app, like, what do you suggest people do? Obviously, research is the key.
Sure. Well, again, remember that it's like buying a Chanel bag that's on sale for $500. You have to remember that you're going into this knowing you may not get what you're looking for. So here's the thing. Because it's unregulated, so you have to say to yourself, before I click on this ad, reputable breeders don't advertise, but I'm going to click on it anyway. Let me just see what happens. You'll be brought to a site that offers to ship or drive the dog directly to you. That is a red flag. It's a red flag because they don't want you to come to where this dog is coming from.
But
so
pause.
When they offer as pause a convenience
for, okay, I was going to say, pause for a quick second, Elizabeth. Doesn't Petfinder do that or no?
No.
Petfinder does not.
Petfinder, hands to paws. So if you're looking, hands to, Petfinder is geared towards rescuing a dog.
Okay.
What you're seeing is, so the number one research for source for rescue groups and shelters is Petfinder. Those are all dogs that are looking for homes. I'm talking about you're getting pop-ups. I shared a photo with you of that fuzzy French bull.
Yeah, it was really cute. But I knew right away when you
really
sent it,
cute.
I was like, oh no, why is she sending me this? And then I realized.
That's right. Oy. That is the hook. That is the hook. So you're seeing adorable photos of adorable puppies, whether it's a corgi, a mastiff, a cane corso, all these adorable puppies. A lot of those are stock images. Mm. You're not going to get that dog. They'll show a video of puppies playing. Pomeranians for sale. That's a stock video. So you have no idea what you're getting. It can result in no puppy, a bait and switch where the photo you see isn't the dog that you pick up at the airport. And that's the worst part. Never, ever, as convenient as it is, never accept the terms of flying a dog to you. If you can't get in the car or get on a plane to go meet a breeder, then you're going to be in trouble. You're setting yourself up for 15 years of a sick animal.
Elizabeth Menigan is here for a few more minutes. She is the creator of Hands to Paws, which is an app that was created to connect people to adoptable dogs in our area. And it's to combat the issue of things like puppy mills. I'm curious, Elizabeth, we're talking about deceptive advertising this morning. Are there accredited places you would suggest people to go to if they want those designer dogs or reputable breeders if they have a specific dog in mind? For example, growing up, I wanted a beagle. I wanted a beagle so badly, and I don't mean just any beagle. I wanted one that looked just like Shiloh from that book, Shiloh. I don't know if you ever read it. When I was a kid, it was my favorite chapter book, and I always wanted that dog, and so we went to a breeder. Now, I remember being very little. I don't know how my parents found this out. I believe it was a connection my father had in business. I don't know for sure, though. Don't quote me. But it was someone they knew was a reputable breeder and that they had, like, a controlled amount that they were giving out. It was only two or three puppies per year, you know, whatever. But if this is brand new, like if this is a breed that you're like, wow, I'm in love. I just love the look of this dog. I think I want this dog. You did research. You're like, yep, it's a great match for me. Where do you suggest they go if they still want that designer dog or a breeder? They don't want a rescue.
Okay. So let's separate pure breed from designer.
Okay.
So a designer dog is a dog that's not acknowledged by the American Kennel Club. There's over 220 dogs. So a beagle is a pure breed.
Okay.
A labradoodle is not a pure breed. A cockapoo.
I see. Because you're mixing breeds.
Correct. When you mix breeds, it becomes a designer dog.
Mm.
They, in the industry, they refer to it as a mutt. I think it's because they find it offensive that they're mixing the breeds. So, number one, if you want to get a designer dog, know that that's coming from a puppy mill. 90% of dogs that are sold online come from puppy mills. Number two, if you want to get a purebred, let's say you loved Doberman Pinschers, you go on the Doberman Pinscher Club of America webpage. It's called a parent association, not the American Kennel Club. It's the Doberman Pinscher Club of America. Every breed that's recognized by the American Kennel Club has their own club. So they all sort of band together. These are people who breed and show These are handlers. These are judges. That is where you go. That is the only place you can go to get a pure breed dog.
So let me just make sure I get this correct, Elizabeth. If you go to a breeder and they say, we are certified by the American Kennel Club, that does not necessarily mean that they're doing things right? Or they are? I'm personally concerned about that. And the reason I say that is because I may currently have a dog that falls under that category.
I'm concerned because some of the kennels that were reported on the Humane Society's Horrible 100 list, which I recommend anyone to take a look at, it's by the Humane Society of America. You can just type in Horrible 100 list. Mm-hmm. A percentage of those offenders and repeat offenders were also registered with the American Kennel Club.
Oh, no way. That's crazy.
Yeah. So I would go directly to the Breed Association because they have their own set of bylaws. They'll say, you want to join this club? You breed, you show, fine. But if you sell to a pet store or you sell online or you get involved in unethical breeding, they kick you out and they basically, you get blacklisted.
Okay, so then maybe that's what we have then. Okay, because they sound very similar, but when we got our golden retriever, that was a contract we had to sign that we would not breed Willow, that she, we had to like, and if we wanted to, we didn't want to keep her anymore. She could not go just anywhere. She had to be returned to the breeder.
That's an ethical breeder. That's what you
okay,
want.
Okay, that's a good breeder. Okay, thank God. So
that's
Willow,
a good
you're clear.
Breeder.
Whew, I got nervous.
That's a good breeder.
I was like,
but
oh,
here's, but here's, here, so here's the alarming, another alarming trend, which there seems to be more every day. Mm. So people, consumers are going to see cute puppies, and most of them, again, they're either the fuzzy French bull, and it'll say adoption. Available for adoption. What they're doing, it's a loophole. And let's take New York, for example. In New York, if you sell more than 9 dogs, you're considered a breeder. And you have to adhere to, there's a lemon law, a puppy lemon law you have to adhere to, which means people have 2 weeks to return the dog. They're getting away by saying, oh no, this is adoption. We're rehoming this dog. But you're still paying full price.
I was just going to say, they're making it out like you're rescuing them, but really they're going to pay, you know,
that's
you're
right.
going to pay top dollar.
That's right.
That's so shady.
And consumers aren't aware of that. And
oh,
I contacted
gosh.
Someone that was doing that. They even offered to drive the dog to me. And I said, but you don't even know who I am. So I was just testing the water to see. And sure enough, it was $3,500 for clearly a French bull. That's a backyard breeder dog. And that's another thing that people need to know. In the state of Connecticut, if you go to a pet store, let's just use a pet store as an example, all the dogs that are in a pet store come from backyard breeders and puppy mills, period. You're not going to get a breed association person who's going to sell a dog. So that's the first thing.
So, like, pet stores are never going to be related to shelters. Like, you'll never see, like, the Connecticut Humane Society giving leftover dogs to a pet store. That doesn't happen.
Never, never.
Okay, got
it. Pet stores buy their dogs from puppy mills in the Midwest, New Jersey, New York. There's not that many in Connecticut.
Yeah.
But pet stores get their supply of puppies from breeders who breed, like, a commercial, like chickens, pork, and beef. That's what they
Jeez.
Do.
Okay.
There's no love involved. There's no testing.
It's business. It's all business.
It's a business. It's a business. So what's happening is people are going to pet stores, buying male and female dogs, taking them home, and going into their own breeding business.
Mm.
They're setting up websites, and they're selling dogs to you directly.
Oh, wow.
You need to be aware, another thing, if you're buying a puppy online, if you live in Connecticut and you fall in love with a dog from Tennessee, what are the state laws? If you don't know, if you get a sick animal, you're basically out of luck. And
right, because maybe they don't
up.
Have to cover that. Maybe they don't have to pay for
they,
that.
No.
Right, right. They're not liable.
People aren't taking into consideration, wait a second, I just bought a dog and it's 2 months old. You never buy a puppy that is under 12 weeks. Puppies are separated too early because they have a shelf life when they go to a pet store.
So, Elizabeth, I think we got to continue the conversation. I think we have more to talk about. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. Again, the app is called Hands to Paws. It's with the number 2. It is free to download, and they also have the website as well. What is the website really quickly, Elizabeth?
It's www.handstopaws.com. And I just want to say I am off to London, to Birmingham next week for Crufts International Dog Show. They've let us be a vendor there.
Oh, wow.
The app is available in the UK and Canada, so it's very exciting.
That is really exciting. So when you come back from London, let's have you back on the show. I know this is a very hot topic for our listeners. As I mentioned, we love our dogs. A lot of our listeners think our dogs are our kids. I'm one of them as well. So would love to have you back on the show, and I want to hear how it goes in London. Please come back.
Wonderful.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elizabeth, and safe travels. Can't wait to hear how everything goes.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
So I know we're talking about the Mexican Wolf Recovery Program this morning. Greg Dancho, I'm curious because I saw on the social medias that there was somebody important at the zoo yesterday. I mean, I know you're very important, very, very important. But there was somebody else who joined you there. I saw a nice little camera crew. What was going on at the zoo this week? What did I miss?
It was interesting. You know, things happen. You know, pretty spontaneously sometimes. And we just got a call that Inside Edition was looking to do a stories on old animals. And it wasn't about me. I thought it was about me, but it wasn't about me.
So crazy.
And they so they called us up and said, you know, do we have any animals that are. You know, especially old. And, of course, Kane comes to mind here at the zoo. Kane is our black collar monkey. And he just passed his 30th birthday. Now, 30 doesn't sound very old, but in howler monkey, he is now the oldest living howler monkey in the United States.
Whoa!
So I remember you saying that.
Yes.
Yeah. So he has a little bit of We talked about our home monkeys pretty much, but yeah. So he got a little bit of airtime yesterday.
Look at it. A little bit of airtime,
but he got airtime.
So did that already air?
Yeah, it was. They came in at 12 o'clock and they aired it last night. So I think I was asleep. It was right there.
Okay.
Yeah, it was
so
right there.
I want to go back and watch that though. So it was Inside Edition.
Inside Edition, yeah, they did a thing on older animals, and Kane was featured on there. Happy to have the zoo on some national TV.
Yeah.
Probably very short. But again, it was fun. They're always fun to do. You know, it always amazes me that when we do things like this with the media, the amount of time for setup and the amount of time to get going and the amount of time to film and then the whole thing that gets filmed.
And then
what the end product is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like...
Yeah, it's incredible. I remember the years I worked in television. My goodness, there were some people who were like, oh, wow, that went by so fast. And then there were people who were like, oh, why'd I do an hour interview? And I'm like, I don't know. I just asked for two questions. But you kept going.
That's good.
So,
but again, it's important for people to know. Again, that's the reason why he's 30 years old. Yeah, here at the zoo. Why is he 30?
Exactly.
So a lot of different reasons for that.
Look at that. Yeah. Very big celebrity. I mean, I knew you were a big deal, Greg, but look at you, you know, sharing the spotlight with the animals. Yeah. Look at Kane. Look at him go.
Look at Kane.
So let's get away from the monkeys for a hot second. Not that I don't love them, but let's talk about the Mexican Wolf Recovery Program. What is that? It's not just the Beardsley Zoo involved with this, right?
No, it's not. Again, we talk about this often, that the zoo, our zoo is here as an accredited member of AZA. We have really four legs on our stool as conservation, education, guest experience, and research. Research we don't really cover, you know, a lot because it's something that we do here at the zoo with our students, but not something on a grand scale. So working with AZA, we are able to bring in and work with them, and they ask us to work with scientists from around the country to work with animals to help them save them and recover them. And the Mexican wolf is one of those. And we have three Mexican wolves here right now. We have two males and a female. And we have now got the scientist, Kamir Sherry Asa, who I've known for many, many years, worked at the St. Louis Zoo. She actually works in a place that they call it the Frozen Zoo. And why they call it the frozen zoo is this place where they preserve genetic diversity.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Through female and male reproductive samples, skin samples, genes. These are put in cryogenic situations forever. I mean, they'll take a sample and that will be frozen in a cryogenic state for as long as it is, if they need it. And will they ever need it? Maybe not, maybe so, but it's there. And that's what's really important about this. And this is why it was so exciting to have Dr. Asa here with her colleagues to go over and get samples from our male Mexican wolves.
Does that include sperm samples? Because I know reproduction is a huge, that's one of the biggest things with conservation. That's why you guys just brought in a new wolf not too long ago.
That's exactly what the males did.
Okay.
They sperm samples. They took a collection of the male sperm, which was then thrown. They checked it out for motility. They checked it out for for amount, and then immediately put it into cryogenics.
So wow!
Right there, and then boom, done. It's been labeled. They're in there now, and that goes into the bank of not just Mexican wolves, but many, 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 many animals at zoos around the country that have this frozen zoo. St. Louis Zoo has it. San Diego Zoo has one. These are, again, kept, in a vault, basically, which sometimes you can almost say it's almost as valuable as what we have right now, because this could be the future of these animals once we're able to use those samples to help bring back the population if they start to go down.
It's interesting.
So the Mexican wolf.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was reading the release from the zoo. We're talking to Greg Dancho this morning. Genetic diversity suffered from the required inbreeding to create a new population, resulting in male Mexican gray wolves today presenting poor sperm quality as a result, which I think is interesting. So having these collections also really important so that when the male wolf passes on, they still have the genes, if they're good ones, to continue populating, which is really amazing. It's very impressive.
If that male had not been reproductive, had not sired any offspring, then once he passes away, that material's gone forever.
Yeah.
However, now with the samples being collected, now it's not gone forever.
You have it there.
And this, again, when we're looking at seven founder populations of Mexican wolves, that shows the genetic adversity is already very low. So it goes back to what we talked about in the past about the SSP program, Species Survival Plan, looking at what we have in the zoos that we're working with and working with Fish and Wildlife. This is a multinational program with the Mexican government to decide how we're going to maintain these animals, what animals are going to have offspring, because we want to make sure the genetic variability is there. But however, if we have wolves that are not reproductive, then potentially we can go to that frozen zoo and pull out that sample and have something that will have a new genetic variability into the population.
Really fascinating stuff during our Zoom Minute this morning with Greg Dancho, learning about the Mexican Wolf Recovery Program and how the Beardsley Zoo is a critical player in trying to preserve and also bolster up the populations for these wolves. I'm curious, Greg, we have a couple more minutes left. Mm-hmm. Are there other populations that are having this genetic freezing, these collections done? Because you and I talk about endangered species and at-risk species all the time. So do we know if there are, are these recovery programs for other animals as well? And if so, how long have they been around?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that right here at Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo, Kuma was our ocelot here that we had in our rainforest. She's a three-legged ocelot. We tried to, and she was a Brazilian ocelot, which her genetic material was not in the population. So we just talked about how important that is, especially when you got a low population of animals. So we tried to do it the natural way, brought a male in. She did not want to have any kind of relations with that male, so it did not work. So we were contacted by the Cincinnati Zoo, who brought in a reproductive biologist like Sherry Asa, like Dr. Asa, who came in with some frozen semen, and we were able to do a in vitro artificial insemination on Kuma, and she had a kitten. and she raised that kitten. That kitten went on to have kittens of her own. We did it again, which was the first time in the world it ever happened that we're able to use the frozen semen sample to have another kitten from Puma, who also went on to have kittens of her own. So right there in our own backyard, in our little tiny zoo here in Bridgeport, we were able to show that how this works to get that population up on an animal that did not have a lot of representation and now is represented very well in the zoo world right now. And eventually, hopefully, for something that in the future, maybe would be recovery to move these animals back in the wild. We've also in the zoo world have worked with cheetahs, rhinos, have all been done with in vitro embryos have been implanted. It has worked in these animals. Other wolves, also horses, elephants, working with elephants right now on that also. So again, it's across the board really on animals that we're looking to again bank as much information as possible. And this is really interesting because again, it's trying to keep these animals on our planet, which we talk about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's even going farther to where some of the scientists are looking at animals that are in museums. And getting DNA samples from museum skins inside some fluid animals that have been extinct for a long time. So now we're getting into that situation where do we want to bring back woolly mammoths?
You know, yes, I've seen the debate on this.
The potential is there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the potential is there to bring back the dodo, to bring it back.
Yeah.
So there is some thought about, you know, the technologies moving forward. When this thing was first started with the frozen zoo, the technology wasn't really even there to see if it was going to work. And now the technology is catching up to the forethinking of banking these samples to be able to be used now. But now it's even going farther into other animals that have not been on our planet for a while. So
unreal.
Yeah, there's some philosophical things to think about. We probably don't want to get into it right now, but yeah, I'm more worried about the animals we have on the planet right now, keeping them here, than worried about the dodo at this point.
I agree. Amen to that, my brother. Well, I think this is very cool, and kudos to the Beardsley Zoo for being such a critical role in this, and I thank you, Greg, for mapping it out for us. You know, sometimes I feel like people enter into the zoo and they see what's at the surface, which is really great work happening, but these are the kinds of stories that I don't know if people realize the importance of the zoo on such a technical level and how you are integrated with other zoos and what this does for, you know, animal populations. It's quite extraordinary. So thank you for sharing that this morning.
No, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity to share it. It's
absolutely. Oh, of course. That's why we've got our Zoom in it every week. There's always something to talk about. Thanks, Greg. Talk again very
care.
Soon. All right. Thanks, you too. Greg Dantra of the Beardsley Zoo here on WICC.